great to see you all coming here on the one day of the year when you could all be dressed up as vampires and prowling around the streets of London. It's a huge pleasure, and it's also quite fun for me to be here with Will. We are both Palfest people in terms of we both have been on the Palestine Festival of Literature, and we are both published by Bloomsbury, and in particular by one editor, Alexandra Pringle, who's the editor-in-chief at Bloomsbury, who's had such vision and has really been trying to get as many Palestinian writers and Palestinian voices out there as possible because of what she saw as a result of going on the festival. So we're here to pay tribute to them and to also to Ahdaf Swaif, who's behind the Palestine Festival of Literature, who would have liked to have been here tonight. So Will's book I also read in one sitting on a plane, and I was really moved by it, and I found it very... I found it just so... It captured me in a way that I felt needed to be done with Palestine, because it really simplified issues in a way that I felt I could bring it to my son, who's 11, and I could also, myself, was thinking and wondering about issues and was, you know, so it hit both audiences for me, both the adult and the young adult. And I think it's also really gratifying if you're a Palestinian writer or if you've ever been involved in, you know, the Palestine issue in any way, to meet someone like Will or to read a book like The Wall, because it's really, Will has gone on his own personal voyage in terms of writing this book as someone from North London who's Jewish, who doesn't need to be connected in any way, but sort of is born into a place which could easily ask him to turn a blind eye to what's going on in the other side. And I think most people generally do turn a blind eye to things, and I'm very impressed by the journey that Will's taken, and I'd like him to talk a bit about that tonight. In fact, I want him to talk. This is what I was saying beforehand. I want him to talk and not me tonight. So I thought, just to start off, I mean, could you tell us a bit about your sort of background growing up being Jewish in London? Not all of it, but just like particularly the issue of like how Zionism was felt around you, how the connection to Israel figured for you.
Yeah, so I'm from a sort of secular Jewish family. My father's father is a Gentile, which is why I'm called Sutcliffe, but my other three grandparents are all Lithuanian Jews. But a very secular background. But I was brought up in northwest London. I went to a school which was about half Jewish. So I have a strange mixture of feeling religious, quite an atheist actually, very much not religious at all, and yet feeling quite identifying as a Jew in some ways, partly culturally through most of my friends were Jewish and I mixed in very Jewish circles, and obviously my family are Jewish, my extended family, some of them are more religious than others. So I felt connected to it in a way that was a little bit confusing, and also culturally connected to it. As a writer, I felt like I responded very much, particularly to American Jewish writers. That was the voice that really got me. The book that got me started as a writer was probably Portnoy's Complaints, actually. I started trying to write funny books, and then most of the books that said on the back, "This is hilarious," weren't. And then I read Portnoy's Complaint, and I thought, there's something in that voice that connected straight to me, and the way particularly American Jewish writers write very much in the language of the street, in a way that I feel a lot of English writing is in the language of the library a little bit. Mm. But in amongst all of this... if you're a Jew, you can't ignore Israel. Mm. So I wasn't brought up in a family where we were told that Israel was great. It wasn't particularly mentioned. It wasn't not mentioned. It wasn't really mentioned either. And yet, in my 20s, I thought I have to have... At this stage of life, my brother became a bit more religious. Not Zionist at all. He's very left politically. But became a bit more religious. And I just felt, I can't ignore this. I need to think about it. And I got some friends, being Jewish and Orthodox, some friends were very connected to Israel. And I spoke to one of them and said, what shall I do? And they said, go here, go there, do this, do that. And I thought, okay, in my 20s, I'll go on a trip to Israel. And I went to Israel and saw some of the Jewish stuff. Also went down into Sinai, went up to Petra, and then went back. And then on the way back, I stayed in East Jerusalem rather than West Jerusalem, because I thought that was important and that was interesting. And my family... are not just Jews, they're South African Jews.
Okay.
They So, and I'd been to South Africa a little bit as a child because my grandparents lived in South Africa. And there's something in East Jerusalem, and I'm sure you'll recognise this, something in East Jerusalem particularly and in Israel in general reminded me of what I'd seen in apartheid South Africa. And I didn't know enough about it to, you know, this is a whole debate about apartheid, which we won't get into at this moment, but I felt something there. I felt you cannot miss this idea of one class of people who rule and another class of people who are lesser in their rights. And I left feeling, on the one hand, look what we, the Jews, built in Israel. Isn't it wonderful? And on the other hand, uneasy. And I remained uneasy about it for quite a long time, but not particularly either Zionist or anti-Zionist. No, definitely not Zionist, but not actively, angrily anti it in the way that I perhaps am now. And it sort of sat on the back burner as an issue for a while. But then as a writer, when the wall started being built, my ears sort of pricked up. And I thought, there's something very interesting about this, partly because it's just this incredible outrage, this sort of moral obscenity, which again, there's layers to that, but in the short version, just so awful and wrong, even without going into all the depths of it. And on the one hand, very specific and unique to this place. But on the other hand, also, just as a writer who's interested in the whole world, I thought reflective of something that's very important happening everywhere. I can't help feeling that the story of our times is the story of the increasing divide between the haves and the have-nots. Yeah. I mean, all the time we're somehow in very, very close contact, we, the haves, to the have-nots. You know, our clothes have been put together probably by people earning a dollar a day, our phones and our computers that we use all the time. We're in this quite close, intimate contact with people who have nothing or very little and are worked incredibly hard. And yet we are in denial about it. We don't think about it. In the whole, we use our phones and put on our clothes without thinking about it or worrying about all of this. And I thought this wall in the West Bank is a physical representation of the sort of moral condition that we're all in everywhere. And I thought this is a subject that's worth pursuing. And I had an idea circling around it gradually. What I originally wanted to do was write something that is sort of specifically about this wall, but also about the way this wall reflects the whole world and this aspect of this whole world. Because what you have in that place is the haves and have-nots right up close, divided by a wall, and the wall is a concrete wall and also a psychological wall. Again, we can come back to this later, but I think the psychological aspect of this wall on both sides is as devastating as the physical impact of physically stopping people going from this place to that place. I mean, so I circled around the subject in that way, and I started writing a book which hadn't quite decided what it wanted to be, about a kid from one side of a wall who goes to the other side of the wall and discovers that what's on the other side of the wall isn't what he's been told. And it was sort of a real place and sort of not a real place. And then I heard about Palfest, and I wrote a letter to Adaf Swift saying, I'm writing this book which is set sort of in the West Bank, sort of not in the West Bank. I'd love to go and find out more. Can I, could I please be part of your festival? And then they discussed it at the meeting and they decided I was okay and they invited me. And that was a sort of quite a shattering experience, actually, because even though I'd done a lot of research for this book, and even though I thought I knew where I stood politically, and even though I thought I knew what the wall was, the physical reality of actually seeing it was really shattering. In terms of just the inhumanity of it, going through Calandia checkpoint on foot with these people who are going through it every day and being there. And there's so much of the narrative that you're taught through the way these things are explained is with this simple narrative of us and them. And all of that is very upside down. If as a Jew you think this is the us, but then here you are in Calandia checkpoint with Palestinians looking up at Israeli soldiers walking around on gantries pointing guns down at you and treating everybody with incredible sort of disrespect and brutality. And so that whole, everything sort of turned upside down by that in terms of who's the us and who's the them, which is sort of the theme of the book already. And then I went back home thinking, I have to be a bit less vague. I have to be more specific. I can't set it in this particular settlement, this particular town. Partly because there are some, even though I tried to make it as accurate as I can, there are some key fictional injections into it. For a start, the whole plot comes from a kid going on a tunnel under the wall, and there is no tunnel. So because the tunnel is fictional, the place has to be fictional. So it has to be detached from a place. It couldn't be set in a named real place. But having seen the West Bank and experienced it, I felt on the one hand a real terror of letting down the people there, and the idea of doing it in any way glibly or badly, or in a way that was didn't do justice to the suffering there, was scary. But also mainly the sense that I had to actually get it closer to that real place. So that was the sort of journey the book went on.
And could you tell us a bit about, you then went back and did research and stayed in settlements. Do you want to tell us a bit about that before you give us a reading?
Yes, okay. So there were several sort of phases to it. So I wrote it. It took a long time to write. I kept having to go back to the beginning and rethink it. So I had this version of sort of vague, slightly more vague place. And then I did a rewrite which was closer to the real place. But the story, I should say, just a quick thumbnail sketch, you haven't read it. It's about a kid who's on a settlement, brought up believing pretty much what a settler kid is taught to believe by his settler parents. And like most children, you believe what your parents tell you,
of course.
But when you become a teenager, you don't necessarily believe what your parents tell you, you begin to doubt them. And he's 13, which obviously for Jewish is a significant age. That's when you become a man, according to Jewish tradition. And I would say part of becoming an adult is questioning your parents, beginning to define your own morality, potentially as distinct from your parents' morality, if you find you can't agree with them about important things. And this is the journey he goes on. So he's in a settlement, and I should explain part of the reason, to make it, the book more plausible, he's with a, his father was a more secular Israeli, his father's dead. He's been dragged to a settlement by a stepfather. So he's already, he's a settler, but he's sort of against his family. Something's gone wrong. He's against his stepfather. So he's in it, but not entirely of it. He wants to rebel. He's primed to rebel. And then when he finds this tunnel in the search of lost football, he goes through to the other side. And of course, what he finds on the other side is absolutely not what he's been told by his parents is on the other side. You know, nasty, terrible, evil terrorists who are just out to get us, who live to that. And somebody on the other side helps him and helps him get back. And all of his notions of us and them and of who are my friends, who are my enemies are shattered, and he has to think for himself. So because it's the story from his point of view, a large proportion of the book is set in his house, in a settlement. And I thought for two reasons, partly for accuracy, I need to see a settlement. And you can see a lot on the internet, but there's not much fiction about it. It was very hard to find out just the basic things like, what do they have on their floors? Is it carpets or tiles? What do they have on the walls? What kind of chairs do they have? How big are their houses? What cars do they drive? Stuff like that. In fiction, if you get a few little things like that right, they sort of pop somehow. You can tell if something's authentic or not. So I thought, on the one hand, fiction, it would be helpful to go there and see it. And on the other hand, I also thought, this book's going to be attacked. And if I can only stand there and say, yes, I've been to Ramallah and Jenin and Nablus and Hebron, and that was my research, then it would be very easy to dismiss me as a sort of biased writer, even though I'm just, I thought, actually, if I go to this, and I didn't think it was possible until I found this people that will take, someone who could take me there. If I can say, I've been to those places, but I've also been to, you know, Alfim and Nashe and Efrat and Ariel and some of these big settlements, and hardly anyone has done both. Very few people have been to both places. I thought, actually, that will give me some authority as a writer, not just as a writer, but as someone who's actually a spokesman for an idea. The political ideas behind the book are important. So I felt like I had to go. And that was, again, a very strange and unsettling experience.
Well, what did they think you were doing? Did you?
Well, I didn't tell them what I was doing, unsurprisingly. And like most people, however deluded and crazy you are, you don't think you're deluded and crazy. And if somebody turns up at your house, you don't automatically. I mean, I didn't go and visit the real gun-toting, crazy, let's take pot shots at people in the fields people.
Yeah.
Because they're there, but they're not all of them. What's weirder are the people who are, they're like sort of suburbanites. So I stayed in one family in Efrat, and they're originally from New Jersey, but their angle was, when you're a Jew, you pray for rain, but you don't pray for rain at home. You're praying for rain in Jerusalem, and this is our land, and again, it's a pretty crazy interpretation of the Jewish tradition, but most of the sites mentioned in the Hebrew Bible are not it's not Tel Aviv, it's not the coast, it's Jerusalem, Hebron, what they would call Shechem. They're still called Nablus, Shechem, which is like an Italian calling London, Londinium.
Yeah.
Because that was the sort of biblical name for that place. And they feel like it is their duty to be in that place. It's a religious duty. So they're very, really weirdly sort of deluded. So, for example, you drive there. When I was there, I said to him, how do you feel about bringing up the children so close to the wall? And he said, oh, we have walls like that next to the freeways in New Jersey, and we call them sand barriers. He literally said that. But one of the weird things, but on the one hand, that makes him crazy. But on the other hand, when you actually see it from the other side, you realize that the whole thing has been constructed in such a way as to make people like him, make it easy for people like him to believe that. So what you and I saw there, we saw this everywhere, 8 meters of concrete everywhere. You're just walking down a seemingly ordinary street and then suddenly, bang, it's there. And it's so shocking and so brutal. And you can see that it's just places have just been killed by it. And at every turn you just come across it in the urban areas. And yet I had an itinerary on my second trip that completely overlapped. And when, because it's not like, I don't know how much people know about the place, it's not like you have the settlement and then the wall, and then on the other side of the wall, this is where the Palestinians live. It's all sort of hugger-mugger. There are settlements on both sides. There are Palestinians living on both sides. The wall follows a crazy, circuitous route. It's not even complete. There are walls within walls. There are little ghettoized villages. Very hard to get, but you have separate road networks. So I was going north, south, east, west, completely overlapping, but never intersecting. Because I was on the Jewish roads, because I was being taken in by left-wing Israeli guides who had a car with a yellow number plate.
Yeah.
So you're in the same place. And one of the strangest things, I don't know if you were taken out on Powerfest, there's a place on the edge of Bethlehem.
I was in Gaza. I didn't do Powerfest.
Oh, you didn't do West Bank?
No, I did West Bank.
All right, the place we're taken to on the edge of Bethlehem, where you look down on one of these key settler roads, which goes from Jerusalem down to the southern West Bank. And you see it's completely encircled, not just by the wall, but by these strange overhangs. There are houses around it where they've got these 8-metre-high wall on three sides within a few yards of their windows. And this road just comes out of a tunnel, goes under this weird concrete overhang and zips out. And we were all taken there as good. And you look down on it and you think, how can anyone drive along this road with a clear conscience? Because it's like the very powerful physical embodiment of military occupation, of pure power, of just sort of destroying this place. And then, you know, about a year later, there on my second trip, going on this road, and on the first time I went down it, I didn't even realise, because this 8 metres high wall, on the other side, they use a land bank, so you can have the same wall, on the other side can look half as big, and then it's got stone cladding on it to make it look pretty, literally pink stone cladding, and it does look a little bit like the kind of sand barrier you might see on a New Jersey thing. And that's one of the rare places where it's next to the road. The whole road networks are constructed. I was looking for the wall, and I would occasionally be able to see it. But if you're not looking for it, you'll literally not see it. And most of the way, the roads are very cleverly constructed so that psychologically it's invisible. So these settlers, when you're there on one side, you think, everywhere you see these people up on hilltops, you think, how the hell can these people come here and do this to this country? It's so that they're on the higher ground. This, the sense of invasion, of having your this place invaded by outsiders is so palpable. But then, if you're on the different networks on the other road, it literally, if you're driving from Jerusalem to a settlement, you would not know whether you've driven to a settlement or whether you've driven to some other suburb. The roads are separate. The settlements feel like any other average suburban anywheresville. I mean, you could be in California. Yeah. And so it's like Alice in Wonderland. It's this sort of fantasy land. So it's built, very cleverly built, to not make them feel what they're doing.
And I think, I mean, that's one of the things you said about your book, which I'd like you to read from, is that, which I thought was a very neat way of putting it. You were saying that instead of the normal parable of when, like, the ball goes over the wall, or the characters in a children's novel move from reality into fantasy, you had your characters moving from this fantasy world, which is in the settlement, into this hard reality of the Palestinian towns.
Yeah, because the protagonist is a child, and I realised that if you're writing a first-person narrative from the point of view of a 13-year-old, if what you write isn't comprehensible to a 13-year-old, you've done something wrong. So just in fictional terms, I think I think there's a difference between what you can say and what you can think. So the language can be more sophisticated than what a 13-year-old would say, but it had to correlate with what a 13-year-old can plausibly think.
Mm.
And I think if you're writing in something that a 13-year-old could plausibly think, ideally it should be something a 13-year-old really can understand. And 13 is pretty young for this book, but I wanted to write something, again, that a teenager, if it's about that age group, I thought a teenager ought to be able to understand. And I realised that on the other... I also realised that, as you were saying, it's very close to a very familiar trope from children's fiction. What you get again and again in children's fiction is protagonist in their ordinary, boring, mundane, everyday life suddenly finds a portal to a world of wonder and fantasy. You know, Secret Garden, Harry Potter, Alice in Wonderland, again and again, portal to a world of fantasy. And then thinking about settlers as a secular person, I thought particularly religious settlers, they are bringing up their children in a world of complete fantasy, living in this deluded notion that their settlements are normal and that they're not invading someone else's place. So I thought I can turn this on its head. So instead, this book is very much about a kid living in a fantasy who discovers a portal to reality. And when he comes through into the Palestinian town on the other side, he's sort of meeting reality for the first time. Which I thought was a nice edit. It's just turning a very familiar thing to a fiction on its head.
Would you read for us now?
Yes, with pleasure. Okay, so I'm going to read a little bit from the near the beginning of the book. So as I've said, the kid goes to the other side of the wall, and some people sort of, who realise that he's a settler kind of go after him, and a girl helps him get back home. And he gets back home, and obviously he doesn't tell his parents where he's been. And he's found this tunnel. He's gone in search of a football in a sort of, there's a building site in the middle of the settlement, surrounded by hoardings. He's never been in there before. He goes into the building site in search of the ball, and the ball leads him to the tunnel. But what he tells his parents when he gets home is just that he got into the building site looking for the ball and stuck in there, couldn't get out, but then eventually did get out. So he tells his mother this, and then the stepfather comes home. And it's the stepfather who's the sort of religious nationalist settler. The mother is more sort of moderate and confused. I need to go back. So the stepfather's called Liev. By the time Liev arrives home, I've washed and changed, and I'm curled up on the sofa in a nest of cushions watching a cartoon. It's about a dog who keeps on trying to leave his house to get the bone he's left outside, but whenever he does, he's smacked in the face with a plank by another, bigger dog who hides in wait for him. The smaller dog never gives up and keeps on looking for new routes to his bone, but every time he gets close, the bigger dog appears with his plank and whacks him over the head. It's pretty funny. Liev does what he usually does when he walks in. He goes to the kitchen. Mum is there cooking, and I can tell by the tense gabble of her voice that she's telling Liev what I've done, or what she thinks I've done, and is asking him to scold me. From the suck and slap of the fridge door, I can hear that Liev is snacking as he talks. I feel him appear in the doorway, but don't look up. Your mother tells me you did something stupid today, he says. I shrug, contemplating my options. I could ignore him, putting off the conflict, but that would just make him angrier. I could be sarcastic, calling Mum your wife to match his your mother, which might be briefly satisfying, but would ultimately make everything worse. It's never worth getting Liev angry. Most conversations I have with him, I'm thinking ahead like a chess player, figuring out my best moves to give away as little ground as possible without pushing him into one of his rages. I glance up and see that although his body's facing toward me, his head is turned and his eyes are on the cartoon. This is a good sign. If he was in the mood for an argument, he'd have switched the TV off before speaking to get my attention. He would have positioned himself in front of me with his hot breath on my face. Having other people's attention is a big thing for Liev. Few things make him angrier than the idea that you might not be listening to him. The way he's standing and his weary tone of voice give the impression he's reprimanding me only to satisfy my mother. She clearly hasn't succeeded in communicating the level of her panic. Everything looks calm now. No one's missing. No one's been harmed. It seems as if he just doesn't believe anything bad really happened. He's going through the disciplinary motions as a domestic chore. I just have to play along. I lost a ball in the building site. It wasn't even me that kicked it there, I say. You gave your mother a terrible scare. I know, I said sorry. Well, that's good, he says, but if you ever... His voice trails away, distracted. The small dog is climbing up the chimney, but the big one has seen what he's doing through the window and is hiding behind a chimney pot with his plank. the small dog's head appears. He looks around and smiles, thinking the coast is clear. He jumps out and is all ready to leap down from the roof when the big dog stands up with his plank and swings it like a baseball bat. Whack! With the sound of a long descending whistle, the small dog flies into the far distance while the bigger dog runs around the four corners of the roof like he scored a home run, acknowledging the cheers of an imaginary crowd. Liev gives a tiny, comma-sized smile and turns back to me. If you ever, you know, lose something in there again, you have to promise you won't go in. Okay, I say. That seems to be it. Easy. If he knew what I'd really done, where I'd been. He's already on his way out when curiosity gets the better of me. Why? I say. He stops and turns, his face now blank and puzzled, as if he's already forgotten what we were talking about. What? He says. What's in there that's so forbidden? I should say that what he finds in the building site is a demolished house. What's in there that's so forbidden? Nothing. It's just private property. Whose is it? Well, it's private, but I suppose it belongs to all of us. So it's public. It's disputed. By who? The people who used to live there. Who used to live there? No one. No one. So who's disputing what? You know what I mean, smart guy, he says with a sneer. They abandon their houses, then act like it's our fault. I saw it. I was in there, I say. I saw the house. He stares at me, not blinking, a cold, level gaze. Have you seen it too? I ask. He shrugs. They're bad people. They build without permits. They don't listen to the government. They don't listen to the army. They only understand violence. What happened to the people who lived there? Where are they now? Gone. Gone where? Somewhere they belong. Why are you asking all these stupid questions? It was weird. The house, it's smashed up, but everything's still there, as if they didn't even pack, as if something just fell out of the sky in the middle of an ordinary day and crushed the place. It felt spooky. You don't have to worry. Nothing fell out of the sky. It can't happen to us. That's not what I mean. I felt something bad. You felt something. Did anyone die? I sense him begin to lose his patience. When these things happen, every effort is made to save lives, but some people don't want to be saved. And people die everywhere all the time. It's normal. What's crazy is that we have to fight so hard for every square inch of land we want to live on. What's crazy is that there are traitors who help those people fight for land that ought to be ours. What's crazy is that some people won't stay where they are put and just go on and on and on, trying to keep us from living normal, peaceful lives. And if you're having feelings and worrying about things that don't concern you, then I suggest you concentrate a bit harder on your studies and spend less time speculating about things you can't possibly understand. Do you hear me? He's now looming over me. And above his beard, I can see his face is flushed with tiny deltas of purple veins lit up around the rims of his nostrils. I shrug and turn back to the TV. The big dog is now hammering the smaller dog into the ground like a fence post. Liev stands over me a short while longer, slightly out of breath from his rant, then slips away back to the kitchen. I don't want to risk talking to him again before dinner, so I flick off the TV and retreat to my bedroom, picking up my school bag as I go. Thank you.
Thanks, Will. I was wondering when you were reading that, when you stayed with the settlers, did you ever have a situation where you might have really disagreed with their views politically but actually quite liked them? Did you ever have situations where you got into political discussions and challenged them? How did the dynamic work in terms of being able to...
Well, it was interesting. I didn't tell them what I was doing there. There's one tour company in Israel who take tourists in Israel into the West Bank, mm-hmm. run by this very interesting guy called Fred Shlomka.
Yeah.
He's a sort of anti-Zionist Israeli, he calls himself non-Zionist Israeli. Mm-hmm. And he mainly takes people into Palestinian villages and does a very interesting half-day tour of the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So he's very aware that Jewish tourists to Israel get given the Zionist. They get the hard sell on a very particular historical narrative, and he gives the other narrative. Mm-hmm. And the Israeli tourist boards have forbidden all Israeli hotels to stock his leaflets. They get taken out. He's not. He can't get his leaflets anywhere. But he goes online, and he gets interesting, the people that go on his tour. And he has young, very committed, very interesting people, very well-informed people who take people on these tours. He has a few contacts in settlements. So mainly for journalists, writers, diplomats, he takes people into settlements. So I, partly to help fund the trip, I wrote a profile of this guy, Fred Schlomka, for a newspaper. So I told the people I was there, I'm writing a profile of Fred Schlomka, that's why I'm here. Which wasn't a lie, it was the truth, it just wasn't the whole truth. But also because if you're there to research, I'm not there to change anyone's mind. I'm not going to change anyone's mind. So I wanted to draw them out, basically. I was researching, I wanted to find out how they think, why they think. I probably want to see what the houses look like, but also how they think, what they think, why they think. And the best way to do that isn't to challenge people. No. It wasn't important what I thought. Yeah. So I asked all the questions I could without betraying what I thought. And if they'd been sensitive souls, they probably would have noticed that I wasn't quite with the program by the tenor of the questions. But that's not the kind of people they were on the whole. And one of the strangest things about it, actually, the guy I was with, the young guy who took me around, he was a fantastic guy. And one of the things that unsettled me in the first family is that in some ways they were sort of nice. I totally disagree with everything they think, and they were totally deluded. But this is one of the things that I said, when bad people don't open the door and say, welcome, welcome, we're bad, they think, however deluded what they're doing is, they don't think they're bad, they don't think what they're doing. They have a justification for it, and the counter-arguments they're either not aware of or willfully blind to it. And some ways they were pleasant, but there were occasions where there was another family that was much more troubling, actually. So that first family in one settlement, they were, New Jersey. They're the kind of people you could meet in Hampstead Garden Suburb very, very easily. Very only minutely different in that they were committed to the idea of living in the West Bank. They thought they were doing a good deed for God by living in the West Bank. But they're sort of unprincipled. It's very strange, bringing up their kids. But they were convinced that they were on the side of the angels, which is very strange. Although there was a guy there they don't have the Red Cross there, they have the Red Star of David, Red Morgendorf at Adom, and then on the Palestinian side they had the Red Crescent. Mm-hmm. So I had a guy there at that dinner who was from the Red Morgendorf at Adom, the Red Star of David, saying, yes, but when we answer the calls, we go here, there, whenever we go to Palestinian villages, we're all friends, we help them. Because he assumed that all people who come there would just go to settlements and then go back safely to Tel Aviv. By a weird coincidence, I ended up 2 days later in the Palestinian village that he'd been talking about. And I said, have you ever seen a Morgan David Adom vehicle in this town? And he said, never, 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 not once. So in that sense, he was going beyond deluded to actually barefaced lies. Completely. He was lying to my face. And that was the line they'd spin to anyone who comes into their settlements about how wonderful they are. Saying, yes, we help everyone. The Palestinians are friends. But their settlement actually wasn't fenced. The wall doesn't go around this settlement, and you can see from the edge of the settlement. It's sort of hard to believe, people don't know it. You see this wall everywhere, but actually there's the settlement, the settlers, and then you could see the nearest Palestinian village with no fence. You could have walked from one to the other, and the security road had been built there on the route of the wall, but the wall had not been built there. And he said, no, we don't need the wall, they are our friends. We get on very well with our neighbours. And he sort of believed this narrative. And then, I teased away at this a bit more. And then later on, I got some interesting resolution on this later. I was in another settlement where the settler family were Moroccan Jews, Sephardi Jews, so Arab Jews. Mm. Although they never let themselves be called Jewish Arabs, interestingly. They're always Arab Jews. And they'd come from Morocco in the 50s, and they'd lived in a different settlement, which is in a much more sort of high-pressure place. Their settlement was fenced, barbed wire all around, right up next to the last settlement. There's a village close by. There was a prison half a mile down the road where everyone knows torture is happening. There's a border guard post very close by. You could feel the palpable tension in the air. And I asked him why he was there. He said, oh, the city's so busy, we like the country air. As if this is peaceful. It was unbelievable. And then one of the other things he said to me that related back to the point before is that he also said, oh, we're on very good terms with our neighbours. You know, I was in charge of this sort of committee from the looking after the settlement, and because I speak Arabic, I deal with the next door village. And when we moved in here, We had some spare lines on the phone, and we had some spare water pipes. And out of the kind, they didn't want me to do it. The authorities didn't want me to do it. But out of the kindness of my heart, I ran phone lines to their village. I ran them water, and we were on very good terms. And then occasionally, if we have any trouble, if there's any stone throwing, I would just cut off the phone to the water. So I thought, I mean, it's an incredible narrative. His version of that is, yeah, we're good friends. We're on really good terms. Look how well we get on. But listening to him, unless you're totally crazy, this is like, these are subhuman people. They're living off the crumbs from my table, and I can shut off their water and their communications like that if I feel like it. But we're friends. In his version of politics, that's friendship.
Yeah.
And that's how, and that was where sort of deluded borders on sort of scarily crazy, even though they're nice people and they're cooking you a barbecue, welcome to my home. And then again, the night after, I'm in a Palestinian town where people have got water tanks on the roof and they're getting water 1 or 2 days a week, and they run out of water by the end of the week. And I stayed in his guest house, and there's a jacuzzi. And so I felt sick. I felt really sick in his home. And his son came in. And very few of the settlers, I didn't really on the whole meet the real crazies. And again, you know, the settler in that, it's funny, when people have criticised the book, someone said, oh, this guy, you've seen in this scene, he's too nasty, he's too much of a caricature or baddie, you're being unfair, you're being biased. But actually, on the scale of settlers, he's kind of in the middle. He's like those Americans, really. They have strong-held opinions. A lot of them carry a handgun. But they don't actually want to hurt people. They're the sort of crazies who really want to hurt people. And when the son of these, he was interesting. He was the next generation of settlers. So the parents, who I was mentioning before, the guy who said that about the communications, he's 60-ish. They moved in the settlement in the late 70s. His sons turned up at dinner, who were sort of 30-ish. So they've been living in, they were the next generation of settlers. He's lived there all their life. So that was quite interesting. They moved in as tiny kids to the settlement. And one of these sons was petrifying. He was like a sort of new age fascist. He was one of these. There's a very tiny number of really crazy people who think that the Dome of the Rock should be destroyed and the temple should be reconstructed. And he was sort of one of those. And he said, the good energy is coming out of that place, and don't worry, it's going to happen. And he didn't want to talk about Israeli politics with me. He said to me, you don't need to worry about us. We've got it sorted. We know what to do. We know how to treat the Arabs. It's you that's got to watch out. You've got to watch out. You've got to be careful. I've been to Edgware Road. They're taking over. I mean, that was his view. It was exactly that. And I was listening to what he was saying, and I was thinking what he was saying was very, very close to sort of the legendary protocols of the Elders of Zion. This kind of the myth that, you know, the legendary slander against the Jews, there's a Jewish plot to take over the world, which was, you know, one of the key tenets of sort of the Holocaust and that. And there's this Jewish settler. He's got a very similar worldview, that there's this kind of Arab plot to take over the world, and we, the Jews, in particular, we're at the forefront of that. I've heard this, there's another phrase I read in a book, that we are the bulletproof vest for Israel and therefore the world. That's what the sort of think see the West Bank as.
Right.
Which is sort of terrifying. But actually, if you go right back in the Zionist narrative, there are elements of that from the very beginning. I think one of the things in Zionism that's been slightly airbrushed is there's the narrative of pre-Holocaust Zionism, when the Zionists of between 1918 and 1939 were trying to persuade the British to create a state of Israel. And, of course, the narrative of that is very interesting, because you're talking about the colonial era, so the narrative wasn't, Israel should be made to exist because of the Holocaust, we need safety, it could happen again, it's a safe place for the Jews. It wasn't that. It was sort of different. It was, the world is filled with the Western powers having colonies here, there, everywhere. That's how the world is always going to be. It's time we, the Jews, had one of our colonies. We should have a colony. Because we're sort of like the white people. We're the sort of people who should be ruling the world. And the narrative of that, and again, it's been airbrushed and sort of forgotten, but if you look at the statements of Chaim Weizmann, David Ben-Gurion from that area, it's very much, we are the bulwark of Western civilization against the Arab barbarians. And like, if you create Israel here, you're pushing back. You're pushing back the East, the Arabs. You're expanding Europe culturally. And again, the narrative all changed because of the Holocaust. But but then if you feel almost like that's sort of been reanimated in the ideology of the settlers.
Oh, it sounds like it. Would it be? I was just, before we open up for questions, I was wondering if you could just say, we didn't give you an introduction in terms of your background. I hope people have sort of read the read about you in your books you'd written previously, but this is quite a big departure for you personally from writing novels about backpackers and set in North London and commitment faux relationships. And I was just wondering how you found the process of publicity with this and how the book has differed in terms of how it's been received, how maybe writing it you'd be more aware of the response to it than with other books, how that might have affected your writing and just what that's been like for you.
Yeah, it does feel very different from the other books, partly because, you know, all books are sort of an emotional thing because you spend a long time on them, but this one, much more than anything else, I felt like, I don't know how to explain it. I felt very invested. You know, nobody wants to spend 2 or 3 years on something for it to fail. You know, you want it to be read, you want it to be well reviewed, you want it to be bought. But more than that, in this book, there's a whole other agenda for me in this book, aside from any sort of sense of personal reward. I hope that this book will have an effect. Mm-hmm. And I feel very committed to the idea that the book could, you know, no novel's going to change. It's not going to change the world, but I hope it's a tiny drip in a in a cause. And it's sort of, and most political novels are terrible, so I felt very scared of trying it. And there's a quote from the Palestinian writer. He said, which writer was it? Emil Habibi.
Yeah.
He said, trying to reconcile literature and politics is like trying to carry 2 watermelons under one arm, which I quite like. This book is sort of trying to carry 2 watermelons, because, you know, most message books tell. But I hope it does have a message.
Definitely.
And I think in terms of the effect, partly that it's going to be read by young people, I think, and it's, you know, it's an American edition of the book. I think that in terms of the political effect, I think there are a number of, the phrase demographic time bomb crops up, partly in terms of the electorate within Israel, the idea that wherever the borders are going to be, if it's the wrong size, suddenly there's more Arabs than Jews and the Jewish state disappears, which is why the West Bank can't be annexed. It has to be in this perpetual state of it is and it isn't Israel, because if it was Israel, it couldn't be a democracy, so it's sort of isn't it? And it has to stay, it's done a state of permanent temporariness. As far as I can see, it always will be, unless there's an incredible change of heart in Israel, which isn't going to happen. But obviously, Israel needs support of America, and I think American Jews who lived through 48 or 67 or 73 have a very strong emotional connection to Israel because they lived through an era where they genuinely believed that Israel was this little sliver of land where it could have been annihilated. And it could have been annihilated in those wars. Mm. And Israeli politicians ever since have sold this story again and again, that we're going to be pushed into the sea, we're going to be in the narrative of total annihilation, which is not explicitly but implicitly referring to the Holocaust. That what could happen here isn't that we'll be invaded, it's that we'll all be slaughtered. That's what pushed into the sea means. We will all be killed. And if you tell that story, it's obviously very powerful, very visceral. And I think the elder generation who lived through 67, 73, feel that in their bones, and that's why they will always support Israel. The younger generation, I'm sort of in the middle, people younger than me, have brought up, haven't lived through that, and are brought up with this drip sense that Israel is the bully boy. And those Jews are not supporting Israel in the way their parents did. And I think that's a good thing. And I think that this book, I hope, is a contributor to that. And as those people come of age, as they get older, once they're in politics and they're older, I think America's support for Israel will become shakier. Although the whole story of American support for Israel is really sticky because it's the Republican Party that is really, really pro-Israel, but most American Jews vote Democrat. 2/3. Romney was funded by Sheldon Adelson, went to Jerusalem, claimed that Jerusalem was the capital of Israel. You know, he was really funded by this Jewish casino, really Zionist. He was right shoulder to shoulder with Netanyahu. If Romney had won that election, God knows what would have happened. He was best, him and Netanyahu were like, you know, he's funded by Sheldon Adelson, he's a big backer of Netanyahu, but 2/3 of American Jews voted for Obama. It's all, I don't even understand it. It's all very, the American Jewish lobby and their power is very confusing because it's not really the bulk of American Jews. It's lobby groups within America who've got the Republican Party in their pocket, and I don't quite know how or why.
Have you been reviewed in Israel?
I was interviewed by the Jerusalem Times.
Oh, okay.
Which is like an online thing. It's not the Jerusalem Post, which is really right-wing. Mm-hmm. It's Jerusalem Times. And that was quite interesting. They were sort of grudgingly positive. I was all set to be attacked. It's funny, I finished the book. And after finishing the book, I carried on researching it because I thought, I'm going to be attacked. And the people that the sort of Zionist attack dog brigade are, you know, they're articulate and clever and they know their stuff. And I thought, I can only defend myself if I know not just what I needed to know for this book, but if I know everything. I need to know what you get attacked with and how to respond. So I carried on doing a lot of research after I finished the book, arming myself for these attacks that sort of haven't come yet. I mean, maybe it's because the book hasn't got prominent enough
yet. States.
Maybe if the book gets more... weirdly enough, I got in the same week, the leading... The Jewish Chronicle in this country ignored it, didn't review it.
Okay.
And the American equivalent, a leading Jewish American newspaper, The Forward, which is an interesting paper. It's, unlike almost any other paper I know, it's very sort of non-aligned. It's a Jewish newspaper, and they'll print something by George Bush, speechwriter, one week, and then something really left-wing the next.
Right.
They're quite an interesting paper. They do the spectrum of Jewish life and opinion and very critical of Israel and very supportive of Israel on the same within the same pages. And they gave it a positive review.
Okay.
In the same week, they got a positive review in Electronic Intifada, interestingly.
Okay.
So I don't think there's probably many books that go along well.
No.
So in a way, I'm at this point, I wanted to be attacked because I was really looking forward to defending myself. Because I don't know.
Does anyone want to attack?
Not here and there. I hope it will be. It hasn't been translated into Arabic yet. I've still translated its rights in about six or seven countries. Interesting. The first country to pick it up on strange was Brazil, interestingly enough, which I thought was interesting. It showed maybe that there's something about, you know, very rich people living in gated communities with poverty on their doorstep. I think it was a story is there in Brazil.
Trend.
So that was interesting. I don't imagine Brazilians are that exercised about Palestine. It showed that it's got some other resonance.
I had a story in a short stories by Palestinian women. Brazil was, it was about to be picked up in Portuguese.
Oh, no other language.
It didn't happen, but that was the one country which was interested. Any other questions? Anybody?
Not France. I think it's still so far in Germany. It's funny. I was told that if you're critical of Israel, the hardest place to get published is Germany. Because they're sensitive about it. But I have sold in Germany, Brazil. I've sold in Catalan, weirdly. I've never sold in Catalan, but I was getting translated into Catalan. And then three or four other places. So it's interesting. I don't know. In a way, in its early days yet, I don't know how it's going to go abroad. But it's funny, one of the most that I recommend, if anyone wants to know more about the West Bank, the... One of the most astonishing books I read on the West Bank is by a guy called E.L. Weitzman. It's called Hollow Land.
Have you read it? I haven't read it, but
it's
I know his work.
Gobsmacking book. So he's an Israeli. He's now lives teacher geographer. He teaches at Goldsmith. Lives in London, and it's this absolutely searing analysis of just the geography of the occupation and how it all works. And it's sort of incomprehensible even when you're there. I learned more from reading his book than from going there almost about how the places intersect, what the occupation is, how it works, why it is, how it happened, who wants it, why they want it, how the factions of Israel, who supports it, who doesn't support it, and why, and how these... It's a brilliant, brilliant piece of work. It's the... best explanation of the situation there you could ever want. And even that, Hollowland, have you got
it's
it?
In the bookshop.
Yeah, Hollowland, E.L. Weitzman, and he cannot get published in Israel. He's Israeli, his book has not been translated into Hebrew. And I find that astonishing. So obviously there's no appetite in Israel for even wanting to understand it. So again, it's the wall. As a psychological wall, and I think that's such an important aspect about it. And the physical construction of it is set up to help that. And one of the places I went to in my research, actually, that I really wanted to, I looked very carefully at the map, and I wanted to see the place where the wall, because I'm sure as most of you know, most of the wall is within the West Bank. There's only 85% is within the West Bank. There's only small amounts of it which are on the green line. I looked carefully at the map, and the Qalqilya is the town that's Palestinian town that sticks out closest into Israel proper, if you want to call it that, and it's surrounded on three sides by the wall, and it goes right up close to one of the big north-south motorways in Israel. And I thought, I really want to drive up that wall, because that's the closest you can... One of the only places within Israel where you will see the wall. And again, you're probably about 100 yards from it, and it is very cleverly concealed. There's a land bank and there's trees. And I was looking for the spot on the map, and I was craning my neck to find the wall, and I could just about glimpse it, just about glimpse it. Meanwhile, I didn't go to Qalqilya, actually. I was going to, it didn't come off, but I'm pretty much sure it's the same as Bethlehem. Like, where every turn you get, if you're trying to leave that town, you will come up against that 8 metres of concrete everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then you can drive 100 yards next to it in the Israeli roads, and you won't see it. Mm. It was the disguise of it that was so shocking.
Well, I think I would like to stop there if there are no more questions. I'd like you all to thank Will very much for a brilliant book and for being here. And let's hope it sells and sells. Thank you.